One of the novels Isaac is reading right now is called Moon Garden. It takes place in a future where Earth's plants have become poisonous, leaching toxins into the atmosphere and rendering survival on the planet impossible. Humanity has fled to space, establishing settlements around the solar system. One of the new settlements is on the moon, where the main character, Myra, lives. Myra longs for things from what the rest of the colony called Old World, the Earth that humanity once knew as its home. Her longing and curiosity reflect a sense of loss. Some of us are already feeling for the Earth before it was subject to the current climate crisis. Moon Garden is hardly the first science fiction novel to imagine a future where Earth has become a more hostile place to live. N.K. Jemisin's Broken Earth trilogy is set on an Earth where the moon has somehow been lost, leaving the planet facing extreme climate consequences. In Becky Chambers' Wayfarers series, even though humans have since discovered they are not the only advanced species in the universe, in fact, they're one of the least advanced, and that there are plenty of options out there for planetary settlement, a group of humans still live on the original spacecrafts that were constructed to flee the effects of climate change. In The Matrix, humans famously scorched the sky in an effort to win the war against the machines by blocking their power source. It didn't work out too well for humans. Ruining our planet never does. It seems we are quite good at imagining nightmare scenarios where we finally succeed in making the Earth inhospitable. As painful as it is, I think that kind of imagination is helpful because it gives us glimpses into potential futures that could become realities if we don't address the climate crisis with creativity and determination. At the end of a novel or a movie where the Earth has succumbed to our torment, I'm always left with a little more appreciation for the beauty around me and a little more determination to try and prevent disaster before it happens. Our passage for today is engaging in a different kind of imagination. It paints a hopeful picture of a vibrant and verdant Earth. A teeming river runs right through the middle of the city of God, where the plants are not toxic like in Moon Garden, but life-giving and sustaining. Strife between nations is healed. God lives in direct communion with people, and humanity dwells in safety and light. The earth and all its inhabitants are at peace, reveling in the harmony that God has brought. Revelation isn't exactly known for cheery, uplifting images like this one, but that's because this one comes at a unique moment in the scriptural story. This is the final chapter in the Christian canon. This image of renewed creation in the city of God is the culmination of the biblical narrative. Everything else has led up to this. It is the image you are left with of the future God desires for creation. The Bible begins in the Garden of Eden and ends with another garden image. This time, however, rather than a humanless rural paradise, we get a city garden smack dab in the middle of God's urban center. The presence of a river and trees that dominate the city may seem foreign to us, but it would have made sense in the ancient world. Throughout human history, our cities have often developed on the banks of life-giving rivers. We couldn't live without them. Water is our life source, but also before we had railways and highways, we needed rivers for faster transportation. Cities on the water were centers of trade and became centers of art, culture, and all sorts of vibrancy. It's no surprise then that the city of God is on a river. A river runs through it as a source of human connection, not just a nice water feature. God's future involves a city, and one that's based on our connection with the earth and its water. Since the Industrial Revolution, cities have developed a bad reputation as centers of pollution and disease, blights on the face of the earth. In particular, Western European cities fit this stereotype in their early development. Buoyed by the emergence of capitalism, industry, and manufacturing, European cities were often covered in smog, home to unsavory working conditions, and thrived on the backs of the destitute. The poor went without proper plumbing, sewers, health care, and other necessities of urban life. The rich either lived in specific districts away from the neglected slums or retreated to their countryside enclaves. This image of a city has endured in popular imagination, especially in the United States. Many people think of an abandoned Detroit, a violence-afflicted Chicago, a smog-blanketed Los Angeles, or a smelly New York City when they think of a city. Never mind that some of those stereotypes aren't true or are rooted in a much more complicated reality. These are often the images we have of cities. However, cities don't have to be like that. And they haven't always been that way. Before Europeans arrived in North America, over 30 million people lived just in central Mexico, for example. That's half the population of all of Europe at the time. Population density was significantly higher than it was in Europe. Yet indigenous American cities were not hubs of poverty and disease. Frequent bathing, innovative hygiene practices, and mostly vegetarian diets kept people healthy. Governance was often based on consensus, and there weren't the same capitalist wealth disparities that drove the urban problems of Europe. Individual autonomy and egalitarianism were such core values of most indigenous people of North and South America that Europeans sometimes found it difficult to convince their own people to continue living a European lifestyle. Benjamin Franklin lamented to a friend that when an Indian child has been brought up among us Europeans, taught our languages, and habituated to our customs, if he goes to see his Indian relations, there is no persuading him ever to return. When white persons have been taken prisoner young by the Indians and lived a while among them, though ransomed by their friends and treated with all imaginable tenderness to prevail with them or to stay among the English, in a short time they become disgusted with our manner of life, the care and pains that are necessary to support it, and take the first opportunity of escape. Anthropologist David Graeber and archaeologist David Wingrow elaborate on this phenomenon a little further. Many who found themselves embroiled in such contests of civilization, if we may call them that, were able to offer clear reasons for their decisions to stay with their erstwhile captors. Some emphasized the virtues of freedom they found in Native American societies, including freedom from the expectation of constant toil in pursuit of land and wealth. Others noted the Indians' reluctance ever to let anyone fall into a condition of poverty, hunger, or destitution. For anyone who has grown up in a city full of rough sleepers and panhandlers, and that is unfortunately most of us, it is always a bit startling to discover there's nothing inevitable about any of this. The truth is, cities are what we make them. And God has a specific vision of what the city at the end of all things looks like. The city of God in Revelation 22 is the realization of human community, the concrete living out of interdependence as the essential nature of human life. It represents, as Eugene Boring says, a recovery of the original goodness of creation by the redemption of the historical process rather than its elimination. In other words, the cities of the earth are part of God's redeeming work, not antithetical to it, so long as they demonstrate neighborliness, bring life and healing, and allow humanity to live in the relational interdependence God placed within our souls. Most cities in our country have a long way to go to resemble John's vision of the city of God in relation and Revelation. I don't think I need to tell you that, do I? Greg Jarrell, one of our colleagues in Charlotte, just released a book called Our Trespasses that analyzes the history of white churches cooperating with urban renewal, which was often a thinly veiled program for systematically destroying and extracting wealth from black and brown neighborhoods under the guise of removing what white officials claimed was neglect, but more realistically, they saw it was an opportunity. In the process, white businessmen reaped the rewards of generations of people of color, demolished their homes, and declared the space their own. Greg wrote a recent blog post in response to a question that he keeps getting regarding urban renewal after these book tours he's been doing. And he says this: I've gotten lots of questions and comments, some of them quite insightful, but one comment has been the most frequent. Some variation on it comes up almost every presentation I've made, either during the Q&A or afterwards in my email. It goes something like this, usually via someone I know to be very nice. I know urban renewal was bad, but without it, we wouldn't have the Charlotte that we have today, Greg. Since the comment keeps coming up, I think it's worth a public response, he says. And here it is. You are correct. Without urban renewal, we wouldn't have the Charlotte we have today. The Charlotte we have today is the most difficult large metro area in the United States for children born poor to get out of poverty. Without urban renewal, things could be different. The Charlotte we have today remains wildly segregated, both by race and by class. Urban renewal reinforced segregation in urban planning and architecture, and without it, things could be different. This morning, it took me 25 minutes to move 4 miles across town by car, and using transit would have taken well over 1 hour. Without urban renewal, we could have had a city with reasonable transit alternatives. It was 84 degrees on the first day of April, one of the growing symptoms of a climate nightmare. Low-density urban areas like Charlotte are ecological disasters. And yet locally, we have a city council determined to make density harder rather than easier. Urban renewal, ironically, went hand in hand with building the massive suburban sprawl that characterizes so many American cities today. So yes, without urban renewal, we would not have the American cities we have today. And on the whole, I take this to be a good thing. Our cities reflect our values. Some of our cities currently reflect the fact that we believe that vast wealth inequality is morally okay, that every person should fend for themselves, that racism and sexism and xenophobia are appropriate responses to our neighbors, that the earth is a resource for us to pollute and deplete. When we cover a city in concrete instead of greenery, it says something about our values, doesn't it? When our cities become a conglomeration of income, segregated silos, instead of a collaborative and cooperative arrangement, it says something about who we are. But salt and light and yeast are spreading in our cities too. There are examples all over the world of people living together in cities and reworking their lives in order to reflect renewed values, values that align with the values of God's kingdom. Our own property repurposing project is a prime example of people working together to make their community a little more like the city of God. The vision of affordable housing above vital services built on one of the town's busiest thoroughfares within walking distance or transit distance to all the town's amenities is an exciting and beautiful one. It is healing and life-giving for those who have been most affected by the housing crisis. And it says something better about our collective desires for the world. Still, we will continue to face resistance to the implementation of this vision. One of the most popular tactics used to stop or reduce housing development, affordable housing development in particular, is the alleged ecological cost. And I can almost guarantee you that you'll hear some version of this argument on May 1st when our property repurposing project is presented to the wider Cary community. May 1st, 6:30, I need you there, just a reminder. Claiming to care for the earth, opponents say that we should stop building, particularly in our cities, because cities are centers of high emissions. But the reality is different. Cities are actually not often the biggest polluters per capita. New York City, for example, produces far less in carbon emissions per person than American cities that sprawl, like Atlanta or Denver, and Chinese cities that depend on rapid industrialization. Cities around the world prove that density is better for the climate than almost any other kind of human development. Tokyo, for example, is almost 6 times more efficient when it comes to emissions than Canada as a country. What we are trying to do at Greenwood Forest is not just be more efficient with Cary's emissions, though. Care for the earth is about more than hitting target numbers, earning certifications, and preventing climate catastrophe. The property repurposing project and every project that cares for the earth is about inclusion. It's about being good neighbors. It's about making sure that all God's children are cared for. It's about reducing our ecological footprint and using the resources we have as efficiently and as generously as possible. It's about creating a community where we acknowledge and celebrate our interdependence on each other and on the land around us. It's about making this corner of the world more like God's dream for the whole earth. We are not flying away to some city in the sky at the end of all things. I'm sorry to be the bearer of bad news, if that's bad news for you. But that is not what Revelation depicts. In Greek, there are 2 words for the English word new, neos and kainos. And neos means something brand new. And kainos means something that has been remodeled, renewed, or restored. And John uses the word kainos here. We aren't going away to a new place. The city of God is coming right here to the earth. Our home is going to be renewed, made into the place where all God's beloved can thrive. It is right here where God's dreams will come true. I saw the holy city, the new Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, John wrote. The city of God is coming here. And in that city, green life teems on every corner. Water splashes the street as children of every tongue and tribe laugh and play. To the thirsty, I will give water as a gift from the spring of the water of life, Jesus said. Generations of pain and trauma and division are healed as people lay down in the grass together, basking in the warm golden light and sharing food prepared with love. A flock of birds takes off from a towering shade tree, a gentle breeze buoying them towards the horizon. Beneath the tree, children play in safety. Leaves change with the seasons as they should. Food grows in the dirt to fill our bellies. And the sun shines on a world free of crisis. Can you see it? Can you hear it? Can you taste it? Can you feel it? Can you imagine it? May it be so. On this corner, and everywhere. Amen.